When you sit down to learn the mechanics of, well, almost any major sport, you're essentially just learning a variation of a board game.
Right, like you're dealing with a fixed grid.
Yeah, exactly. Take chess, for instance. You have this beautiful, rigidly defined grid. The squares never move.
E4 is always E4.
Right. You memorize the geography, and that geography is it's an absolute objective certainty. And a basketball court is exactly the same way.
It doesn't change.
No, the 3-point line doesn't care who is holding the ball. It just sits there, canted on the hardwood, completely static.
It provides a fixed environment, you know? You learn the dimensions, you figure out how the pieces are allowed to move within those specific boundaries, and you build your strategy around that permanent architecture.
Because the spatial reality never betrays you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then you step into the world of ice hockey.
Oh, boy. Yeah. And suddenly, that chessboard starts doing something completely bizarre. It starts breathing.
Right, it stretches out, it compresses.
And the actual names of the squares, like the literal diagnostic zones you use to communicate with your teammates, they change their identities based purely on who is holding a 6-ounce disc of vulcanized rubber.
It is the ultimate relative landscape.
It really is. You are dealing with a landscape that is completely unapologetically fluid.
And that is exactly what makes the learning curve so incredibly steep for people, especially for fans who are trying to move beyond just, enjoying the visceral thrill of the game to actually analyzing it.
Well, welcome to this deep dive. We are thrilled to have you here with us today. Our mission is, well, it's a big one.
It's a massive one.
We want to take you from being someone who loves the speed, the hits, the highlights of hockey, and turn you into someone who can literally read the game like a professional coach.
Like a pro.
To do this, we've pulled together an incredible stack of source materials. We are synthesizing comprehensive rink mapping guides, spatial terminology manuals, and the actual conflicting diagnostic rule books.
Oh, the rule books
Yeah.
from the NHL to the IIHF to England ice hockey.
Right, the ones that govern this sport globally. And we are not going to just read a glossary of terms at you.
No, because to truly grasp the sport of hockey, you have to conquer its spatial geometry. The vocabulary is just, it's just the tool we use to describe that geometry.
Yeah.
The challenge for a lot of dedicated fans isn't that they can't memorize the word strong side, it's that they struggle to accept that strong side isn't a place on the ice.
It's a condition.
Exactly, it's a condition. The exact same patch of frozen water is the high slot for one player and the low slot for another, and that designation flips in like a fraction of a second.
So we're going to build you a rock-solid, integrated mental model of the ice. We want you to be able to sit down weeks or months from now, watch a game, and instantly recognize why a defenseman made a split-second pinch.
Or why a winger abandoned a loose puck.
Right, based entirely on the hidden architecture of the rink. So let's start with the canvas itself, because the biggest illusion in hockey, the thing that trips up almost everyone, is the assumption that a hockey rink is a standardized piece of equipment.
You naturally assume standard dimensions. I mean, why wouldn't you?
You just assume a rink is a rink.
But the physical reality of ice hockey infrastructure is shockingly chaotic. Let's start with the baseline that most North American fans have just hardwired into their brains, which is the NHL standard.
Okay, lay it out for us.
Every single National Hockey League rink is precisely 200 feet long by 85 feet wide. That footprint is non-negotiable.
So 200 by 85, that's the gold standard we watch on television.
Right. The corner radiuses are uniform. The distance between the blue lines is uniform. It is a known fixed geometric entity.
Which feels safe, but then you leave North America.
The moment you leave North American professional leagues, that standardization totally shatters. Look at the international standard governed by the IIHF.
Right, which people colloquially refer to as Olympic ice.
Exactly. Now, the IIHF rulebook mandates a length of exactly 60 meters, which translates to roughly 197 feet.
So functionally identical to the NHL length.
Basically, yeah. But the width is where the entire game changes. The IIHF does not mandate a single rigid width. They authorize a permissible range.
Wait, a range?
An international rink must be between 26 meters and 30 meters wide.
Hang on, that's a massive variance. A 4-meter difference means two completely legal, internationally sanctioned rinks could have a width discrepancy of what, over 13 feet?
13.1 feet, to be
All
exact.
right.
And that completely alters the physics and strategy of the game. The classic big ice that everyone romantically associates with European hockey, the massive sweeping sheets where players seem to have all day to pass,
Yeah.
that's the 30-meter version.
Okay, so how does that compare to the NHL?
That translates to about 98.4 feet wide. Compared to the NHL's 85 feet, you are adding roughly 6.5 feet of extra ice to both sides of the rink.
See, I always just assumed that if tournament was labeled international, they were playing on that massive 98-foot sheet.
Most people do.
But based on the rink mapping data we have here, that assumption is actually totally outdated, isn't it?
It is entirely outdated. In fact, wide Olympic ice is rapidly becoming the exception rather than the rule at the highest levels of global competition.
Interesting.
Yeah, if you look ahead to the 2026 Milano Cortina Winter Olympics, they are officially playing on a 60-meter by 26-meter sheet.
So 26 meters, that's about 85.3 feet.
Right. They are essentially playing on an NHL width rink. And this isn't even a new trend. You know, Vancouver in 2010 and Beijing in 2022 both utilized NHL-sized sheets for their Olympic tournaments.
So the governing body allows this massive 13-foot variance, but the trend is shrinking back down to the 85-foot width.
Exactly.
But what about at the grassroots level? Because I was reading the documentation for the UK leagues, and this is where it really seems to just go completely off the rails.
Oh, it really does.
British hockey officially runs on the IIHF rulebook, but they've written in some aggressive local amendments for their infrastructure.
The situation in the UK is fascinating from a spatial perspective.
Mm-hmm.
England Ice Hockey, or the EIH, recognizes that they are dealing with older buildings, community leisure centers, legacy architecture.
Right, places that weren't necessarily built just for hockey.
Exactly. They simply don't have the real estate for massive standard rinks.
Mm.
So they actively authorize rinks that fall well below the absolute minimums allowed internationally.
How small are we talking
about? We are talking about rinks that are under 56 meters in length and narrower than 26 meters.
That's less than 183 feet long. You're chopping almost 20 feet off the length of an NHL rink.
It's a huge difference.
If I'm a player whose entire internal timing mechanism is calibrated to a 200 by 85 foot grid, and I step onto one of these hyper-compressed UK rinks, or conversely, I step onto a massive 98 foot European sheet, what am I actually experiencing?
It's a shock to the system.
How does the geometry dictate the gameplay?
Well, let's look at the wide ice first, the 98 foot sheet. The immediate physical sensation is that the corners of the rink are suddenly much deeper and further away from the net.
Right.
And this completely neutralizes one of the most common North American tactics, which is the dump and chase.
Okay, let's break that down for the listener. The dump and chase is where you shoot the puck deep into the opponent's corner, bypass the defenseman, and sprint after it to physically win the battle on the boards.
Exactly. It's very North American. On an 85-foot NHL rink, the distance from the blue line to the corner is short enough that a fast forward can get there at roughly the same time as a retreating defenseman,
creating a 50-50 physical battle.
Right. But on a 98-foot wide rink, that corner is significantly wider. The puck has to travel a longer, wider arc around the glass. By the time the attacking forward skates that extra distance, the defending player has already retrieved the puck, looked up, and has, like, three passing options available.
Because they had so much more time.
The geometry makes the dump and chase incredibly inefficient on wide ice. You're basically just handing the puck over to the defense.
I can see that. And what about the physical aspect? Because if I'm a defender, my entire job is to separate the attacker from the puck. On an NHL rink, the boards act as my teammate.
They absolutely do.
If I angle a guy toward the outside, he runs out of real estate really fast.
The boards are the ultimate enforcer in North American hockey. You close the gap, you force the puck carrier outside, and within two strides, they are sandwiched between you and the glass.
It's a guaranteed kill shot for the play.
Yes, but on wide ice, you force an attacker outside, and they just keep going.
Because the boards aren't there yet.
Right. They have an extra 6 feet of ice to operate with. They can absorb the angle, maintain their speed, and just skate in a wider circle down the wing.
That's wild.
It means defensemen can't rely on brute physical angling. They have to rely on meticulous gap control and really active stick positioning. It completely changes the biomechanics of defending a rush.
That explains the width. But what happens on the opposite end of the spectrum? Like if I'm playing on one of those older 180-foot recreational rinks where the length is drastically compressed, I'm assuming the defensive zones just shrink, right?
This is such a great question. And here's the structural secret of hockey rinks. The neutral zone, that middle section between the two blue lines, almost never changes length.
Wait, really?
Yeah. In the NHL, the neutral zone is 50 feet long. On international ice, it's roughly 15 meters, which is just under 50 feet.
Okay.
So when a rink is built shorter than standard, they don't shrink the neutral zone. They shrink the ends of the rink. the distance from the blue line to the goal line gets compressed.
Oh, wow. Which means the real estate where all the actual scoring happens is incredibly claustrophobic.
It's suffocating.
If I try to set up an offensive cycle, the defense is instantly on top of me because there is simply less square footage to hide in.
Exactly. The time you have to make a decision shrinks dramatically. And conversely, if a rink compresses the neutral zone to preserve the end zones, which sometimes happens, the stretch pass basically evaporates.
Because there's no room.
If your blue lines are only 30 feet apart instead of 50, there's no room to accelerate through the middle of the ice. You are constantly in a traffic jam.
Okay, so the physical box we are playing inside is definitely not a constant. It morphs depending on the continent, the league, and the specific building.
It's alive.
But we haven't even talked about how the players conceptualize that space. Because the rule book divides the ice into three official zones. The defending zone, the neutral zone, and the attacking zone.
Right.
But from reading through these spatial guides, it seems like beginners fundamentally misunderstand how these zones actually work.
This is the massive cognitive leap you have to make to read the game like a coach.
Let's make that leap.
So beginners look at the ice, they see the two blue lines, and they assume the rink is painted into three permanent territories. They think of the left side of the ice as the defensive zone and the right side as the offensive zone.
Right, like a basketball court.
But those zones do not belong to the paint on the ice. They belong to the team.
It's like learning stage directions in a theater.
That's a perfect analogy.
If a director tells an actor to move stage left, it has absolutely nothing to do with where the audience is sitting. Stage left is entirely dependent on the actor's orientation.
Right.
If the actor turns around, stage left moves with them. In hockey, the defensive zone is simply whichever end of the ice currently houses your own goaltender.
That is exactly how to visualize it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason this matters so much is that teams swap ends of the ice after every single period.
Right.
So the physical patch of ice that was your defensive zone in the first period, where you were desperately blocking shots, becomes your attacking zone of the second period.
Mm-hmm.
The label follows the goalie.
Which means the exact same square foot of ice is simultaneously your defensive zone and your opponent's offensive zone at the exact same moment.
Yes. And it creates so much confusion for casual fans.
I can imagine.
If you are sitting in the stands and a player yells, "Get it deep," a beginner might wonder which deep end they mean. An expert tip for reading the game and for talking about it intelligently is to completely eliminate the words offensive and defensive from your vocabulary when describing locations.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Coaches rarely use them in the heat of a game. They say our end and their end.
Our end and their end. That makes so much sense.
It removes all ambiguity. Our end is where our goalie is. Their end is where we want to score. It is impossible to misinterpret under pressure.
So let's tie this back to the listener.
Yeah.
What should we remember here? If I'm taking all this in the variance in width, the variance in length, the relative nature of the zones, and I'm stepping onto an unfamiliar recreational rink for the very first shift of a game, how do I practically map this space in my head before the puck drops?
You need to do a rapid environmental diagnostic.
What am I physically looking for?
When you take your first lap during warmups, deliberately check three things. First, skate behind the nets and measure the distance from the goal line to the end boards.
Just visually check it.
Right. Is there room to actually skate with the puck, or is it hyper-compressed? If it's tight, you know wraparound plays are going to be really difficult.
That's smart. And the second thing.
Second, look down at the ice behind the net. Is there a painted trapezoid? We'll get into the mechanics of that later, but the presence or absence of that shape tells you exactly what rulebook your goalie is operating under.
That is a huge visual cue. And what's the third thing?
Intentionally shoot a puck hard around the corner boards along the glass. You are testing for dead spots.
Dead spots.
In older rinks, or rinks with different acrylic composite boards, the physical response of the wall changes. On an NHL rink, a puck rimmed around the boards will carry its velocity all the way to the other end.
It just glides.
But on some community rinks, the puck will hit a certain stanchion and just die, dropping flat onto the ice.
Oh, wow.
If you're a defenseman, knowing where those dead spots are is a massive tactical advantage. You can rim the puck hard, knowing it will magically stop right on your winger's stick instead of flying past them.
That's fascinating. You are essentially testing the physics engine of the specific building you are standing in.
Exactly. You are playing the building just as much as you are playing the opposing team.
So the major takeaway for the listener here is that the ice is not a static grid. It's a living environment. It expands, it contracts, the zones are completely relative to the team, and the physical materials of the rink itself alter the movement of the puck.
That's the baseline you need.
Which brings us perfectly to the actual markings on the ice. We've established the outer boundaries, the walls of the box. Now let's dive into the lines that divide that box and trigger the rule book.
Let's do it.
I want to start dead center with the center red line.
The center red line is visually distinct. It's 12 inches wide, but unlike the blue lines, which are solid, the red line is painted with a checkered or dashed pattern.
Why is that?
This is a very intentional design choice so that players, and more importantly, the officials, don't visually confuse it with a blue line when making split-second offside calls.
That makes a lot of sense. But from my reading, it seems like the center red line has lost a bit of its prestige over the years. What is its primary function in modern game?
Today, its main job is dictating the rule of icing.
Icing.
Right. Icing is a rule designed to prevent a defending team from just blindly clearing the puck out of panic.
Okay, break that rule down for us.
The rule states that if a player shoots the puck from their half of the ice and it travels all the way down the rink and crosses the opponent's goal line without being touched by another player, the play is whistled dead.
And the penalty for that?
The puck is brought all the way back to the defending team's zone for a faceoff. And under modern rules, the team that committed the icing is not allowed to substitute tired players. It's a severe punishment.
Right, so to avoid icing, a player who wants to dump the puck deep has to make sure they cross that center red line before they shoot it. In hockey parlance, they have to gain the line.
Gain the line, exactly.
But when we actually look at the spatial mechanics of this, what does gaining the line actually mean? Because this seems to cause endless arguments in the stands.
And this is where the geometry gets incredibly granular. This detail right here separates casual observers from students of the game.
Okay, listener, pay attention to this.
To legally gain the line and nullify a potential icing, the puck must make physical contact with the center red line while it is on a player's stick.
Wait.
It is entirely about the exact geometric location of the puck on the blade of the stick.
I really want to clarify this. Let's walk through a scenario. Let's say I'm skating up the ice, my skates cross the red line, my chest crosses the red line, my entire body is physically in the offensive half of the rink.
Okay, you're over the line.
But the puck is trailing behind me on my stick blade, and the puck itself is 2 inches shy of the red paint. If I fired it down the ice from that exact position, is that icing?
Yes, that is icing.
Are you serious?
Completely. The position of your body is completely irrelevant. The linesman is watching the puck, not your skates. If the puck has not touched the red paint before it leaves your stick, it is a violation.
That is wild.
It is a game of inches, and that half-stride of possession matters immensely when a tired team is trying to get off the ice.
The officiating requires a level of geometric precision that is almost hard to fathom at high speeds.
It really is.
But you hinted earlier that the red line used to do more. Why did it lose its power?
Historically, the red line was the most restrictive line on the ice because it governed the two-line pass rule.
The two-line pass.
For decades, a player was not allowed to pass the puck from their own defensive zone across the blue line and across the center red line to a teammate. If a pass crossed two lines, the play was blown dead.
Which essentially meant you could only advance the puck 50 feet at a time.
Exactly. It forced teams to play a slow, methodical, plodding game through the neutral zone. It allowed defensive teams to set up the infamous neutral zone trap,
where they would just stand in the middle of the ice and suffocate the offense.
Right. The game became incredibly slow and low scoring in the late 90s and early 2000s. But coming out of the 2004-2005 lockout, the NHL completely abolished the two-line pass rule.
And that single rule change essentially birthed the modern era of hockey.
It changed the spatial mechanics of the game overnight. By removing the red line's passing restriction, the NHL legalized the stretch pass.
Which looks like what?
Suddenly, a defenseman, standing behind his own net, could fire a laser beam pass 100 feet through the air to a winger sprinting at the far blue line.
Wow.
It forced defenders to back up, it opened up the neutral zone, and it exponentially increased the speed of the game. The red line went from being a brick wall to just being an icing marker.
That is a brilliant example of how altering the rules of the geometry alters the evolution of the sport.
Okay, moving outward from the red line, we encounter the two blue lines.
The blue lines.
We talked about how they define the 50-foot neutral zone, but their most critical function is triggering the rule of offside. Right. Offside is the fundamental rule that governs attacking territory. The basic premise is simple. The puck must enter the attacking zone before any attacking player does.
Got it.
You are deemed offside if both of your skates completely cross the attacking blue line into the zone before the puck crosses the line.
But once again, the physical architecture of the line itself becomes a weapon. Think about this. Why is the blue line painted 12 inches thick instead of just being a thin marker? Internationally, it's 30 centimeters. Why a full foot thick?
It is thick because it is designed to act as a physical buffer zone. It's a volume of space.
Explain that volume.
The rule book dictates that the puck is not considered inside the attacking zone until it has completely crossed that entire 12-inch threshold.
Okay, so it has to clear the paint entirely.
Right. But conversely, a player who is touching any part of that 12-inch blue paint with their skate is still considered to be in the neutral zone.
So the line is essentially neutral territory, and this creates one of the most acrobatic plays in sports.
Yes, the toe drag entry.
Describe that for the listener.
Because of that 12-inch buffer, a player receiving a pass can lean their entire upper body, their stick, and their lead leg deep into the offensive zone, as long as they deliberately drag the blade of their trailing skate on the blue paint.
They stretch themselves out to exploit the geometric volume of the line?
Exactly. It's not a loophole. It's using the architecture exactly as it was intended to maintain momentum while staying legally onside.
But I notice a massive contradiction in our source materials regarding this exact play. And frankly, this seems like it would cause chaos for amateur players.
Oh, it absolutely does.
What happens if a player is stretching out to receive that pass and their back leg is trailing behind them, but the blade of their skate is hovering like an inch in the air directly above the blue line? Are they onside or offside?
That is the million-dollar question. And the answer depends entirely on which rulebook is governing the building you are standing in.
Let's start with the pros.
Under the NHL rulebook and the IIHF international rulebook, the blue line is treated as a three-dimensional vertical plane. If your skate is hovering in the air above the blue paint, you are perfectly onside. You have not crossed the plane.
Okay, so air is fine in the pros and internationally. What about amateur leagues?
If you are playing under USA Hockey rules or Hockey Canada rules, the vertical plane does not exist.
Wait, what do they use?
The rule explicitly states that you must maintain physical skate contact with the ice. If your skate lifts off the ice, even by a millimeter, while your other skate is in the zone, you are offside.
That is absolutely maddening.
It's a huge adjustment for players.
You can perform the exact same biomechanical movement, a perfect athletic stretch to receive a pass, and in one league, it's a highlight reel entry, and in another league, the whistle blows and kills the play. Why the discrepancy?
It comes down to officiating infrastructure. The NHL has dozens of high-definition cameras and video review rooms in Toronto. They can freeze a frame and see exactly where a skate is in the air relative to the paint.
Right, they have the tech.
But amateur leagues rely on a single linesman looking at the play in real time at ground level. They don't have video replay. It is much easier for a human eye to judge physical, tactile contact with the ice than to judge a hovering skate against a painted line.
Oh, that actually makes a lot of sense.
So they mandate physical contact just to make the officiating manageable.
So what should we remember here? The 12-inch thickness is a buffer. The red line requires the puck on the stick for icing. And if you are playing amateur hockey, keep your skate glued to the ice on an entry.
That's the perfect summary.
Moving along, this naturally brings us into the most protected, heavily regulated real estate on the rink. We are moving from the lines that span the ice to the painted shapes designed to protect the goaltender. Let's explore the goalie's domain, starting with the goal crease.
The goal crease is the light blue semicircular area directly in front of the net.
Give us the exact dimensions.
To give you the dimensions, in the NHL, it is 8 feet wide at the goal line, and it extends out 6 feet deep to the absolute apex of the arc. But the most important conceptual leap a student of the game needs to make is realizing that the crease is not a flat patch of paint on the ice. It is a three-dimensional volume.
I love this concept. It's like an invisible force field, a cylinder extending up from the ice.
Exactly. In the NHL, that protective volume extends exactly 4 feet vertically from the surface of the ice, which aligns with the top of the goal frame.
And internationally.
Under IIHF international rules, that cylinder extends slightly higher to the top of the crossbar. But either way, it is a legally defined block of protected airspace.
And this airspace is critical because of the rules surrounding goaltender interference.
Right.
The overarching philosophy is that an attacking player cannot impair the goalie's ability to move freely or make a save inside that specific volume. But I want to get hyper-pedantic here because the margins are so razor thin.
They really are. Let's hear it.
The blue paint of the crease is outlined by a 2-inch red boundary line. Does that red line belong to the crease or is it outside the crease? If I park myself right on the edge and my toe is touching the red paint, am I inside the goalie's domain?
You have just hit on one of the most contentious, heavily debated details in hockey officiating.
Because it's different everywhere.
The answer, once again, fractures depending on the rulebook. If you are playing under IIHF international rules, USA Hockey or Hockey Canada, the rule is explicitly clear. The red boundary line belongs to the crease.
Okay.
If a single millimeter of your skate touches that red line, you are legally inside the crease.
And the NHL. Because we see highly controversial interference reviews in the NHL all the time.
The NHL rulebook is dangerously, almost comically ambiguous on this specific point.
You're kidding, it doesn't say.
The main text of the rulebook never explicitly defines whether the red line is inside or outside the volume.
That is insane for a multi-billion dollar league.
It is. The only place it is mentioned is buried in an appendix table regarding screening scenarios. That appendix implies that if an attacking player is standing on the crease line, a subsequent goal is allowed to stand, suggesting the line is outside.
But that's just an implication.
Right. Relying on a vague appendix table when a playoff game is on the line is a nightmare for coaches.
So, as a practical piece of advice for the listener, whether they're playing or analyzing the game, what is the masterclass instruction?
The instruction is absolute. Respect the red line. Keep your skates completely off of it. Do your work an inch outside the paint.
Because standing just outside the crease is actually a massive fundamental part of offensive strategy?
Yes. You are talking about screening.
Right. Screening the goaltender.
Establishing physical position right on the edge of the crease to block the goalie's line of sight without actually touching them. It is generally perfectly legal provided you are outside that 3D volume.
Because the space outside is fair game.
Exactly. The goalie has a right to the space inside the crease. They do not have a right to the space outside of it. If a goalie pushes out to look around a screen and makes contact with an attacker who is legally established outside the crease, that is the goalie's problem.
But if I drift backward into the blue paint, the rules change drastically.
Completely. And again, amateur rules are brutal here.
How so?
Under USA Hockey rules, they employ a strict, flat positional bar. This means that if you are standing inside the blue paint and your teammate shoots and scores, the goal is automatically disallowed.
Even if I didn't touch the goalie.
It doesn't matter if you touched the goalie. It doesn't matter if you were completely out of the play. You voided the goal simply by occupying the restricted volume.
That seems harsh.
They enforce this strictly to prevent youth players from dogpiling on top of young goalies. Hockey Canada is slightly more nuanced. If you are in the crease but completely passive, the goal might survive a review. But the risk is immense.
Okay, so that is the front of the net. Let's move to the space behind the net, the restricted area known as the trapezoid. This is such a fascinating piece of physical architecture because it has such a specific historical origin.
It really does. It's a great story.
First, just outline the shape for us.
In the NHL, the trapezoid is a geometric shape painted behind the goal line. It is 22 feet wide at the goal line itself, and it widens out to 28 feet where it hits the end boards.
And what's the rule governing it?
The rule is incredibly punishing. The goaltender is only permitted to play the puck behind the goal line if the puck is located inside that specific painted shape.
And if they don't?
If a goalie roams into the corners and plays the puck outside the trapezoid behind the goal line, play is stopped, and the goalie is assessed a 2-minute minor penalty for delay of game.
And just to clarify the geometry for everyone, this is based entirely on the location of the puck, right? Not where the goalie skates are.
Correct. In the NHL and IIHF, it's about the puck's location. The only exception is if the goalie leaves one skate in physical contact with the goal crease while they stretch out to play a puck that is technically outside the trapezoid.
I always compare the trapezoid to one of those invisible electronic fences people use for their dogs. The goalie can roam around, but the second they touch the puck outside the zone, they get a shock, a 2-minute penalty.
That's exactly how it functions.
But we have to talk about why this shape even exists. Because this wasn't always part of the game. The The NHL literally had to invent this geometry and paint it on the ice to stop one specific player.
You were talking about the Martin Brodeur rule.
Exactly. For those who might not know the history, Martin Brodeur was a legendary goaltender for the New Jersey Devils in the 90s and 2000s, and he was arguably the greatest puck-handling goalie of all time.
He fundamentally broke the tactical systems of the opposing teams.
How did he do it?
When a team would try to establish a forecheck by dumping the puck into the Devils' corners, Brodeur wouldn't just stay in his net. He would sprint out into the deep corners, stop the puck, wait for his forwards to get open, and fire pinpoint 80-foot breakout passes up the ice.
He acted as a highly elite third defenseman.
Exactly. Teams found it literally impossible to sustain offensive pressure against New Jersey because Brodeur short-circuited every dump-in.
He was too good. So the NHL solution wasn't to change the offside rule or the icing rule. They literally took out a paintbrush and drew a box behind the net, legally confining him to that space.
They changed the physical architecture of the rink to legislate his skill out of the game.
It is a stunning example of spatial geometry being used for rule enforcement. They forced goalies to stay in the middle, allowing the attacking forwards to retrieve pucks in the corners again.
Right. It saved the forecheck.
But returning to our theme of conflicting rule books, does every league use a trapezoid to restrict their goalies?
They absolutely do not. The NHL and the IIHF use the trapezoid. But if you look at USA Hockey and Hockey Canada, they do not have a trapezoid painted on the ice. The area behind the net is completely blank.
Wait, if I'm playing amateur hockey and there is no trapezoid, does that mean my goalie can roam completely free? Can they go deep into the corners and play the puck without getting a penalty?
This is where players get trapped. The physical lines aren't there, but severe restrictions still exist.
What kind of restrictions?
Under USA Hockey and Hockey Canada rules, a goalie is perfectly legally allowed to skate into the corner and play the puck with their stick. However, they are strictly forbidden from freezing the puck or falling on the puck outside the immediate vicinity of the crease.
Oh, I see.
If a goalie goes into the corner, gets pressured by a forechecker, and panics and covers the puck with their glove to force a whistle, they're immediately hit with a delay of game penalty.
So they have the freedom to act as a defenseman, but they assume all the risk. They can't use their goalie privilege to stop the play.
Precisely. Furthermore, both rule books state that a goalie can never carry the puck past the center red line, or they get a penalty.
Okay, so there are invisible rules.
And just to add one more layer of chaos to the global map, the rulebook for England ice hockey explicitly states that while the trapezoid might be painted on the ice in some rinks, the rule is not currently enforced.
So you could have the geometry painted on the ice, but the officials are instructed to ignore it. That is a tactical nightmare.
It is, and it fundamentally alters how a defenseman plays the game.
How does it change a defenseman's job?
Think about it. If you are a defenseman in the NHL, you know your goalie cannot leave the trapezoid. If a puck is dumped deep into the corner, you know, with absolute certainty that you are on your own.
You have to go get it.
You have to skate back, absorb the physical hit from the forechecker, and dig the puck out yourself. The breakout system is built entirely around that constraint.
And if there's no trapezoid?
If you are playing in a league without a trapezoid, your breakout system completely changes. Because you know your goalie can skate out, act as a pressure release valve, and pass the puck up the boards for you.
That perfectly summarizes the goalie's constraints. It is an intricate web of 3D volumes, red lines, invisible dog fences, and legacy rules.
It really is a lot to map out.
So remember this. Respect the airspace of a crease to avoid interference, and memorize your specific league's rule book regarding the corners, because it dictates how your entire team transitions out of the defensive zone.
Absolutely.
Which brings us naturally to the next phase of our map. We have protected the goalie's real estate. Now, we need to map out the territory where the attacking team is desperately trying to gain entry. Let's look at the geometry of scoring, and specifically, the architecture of the end zone.
This is where games are won and lost.
I want to start with the most famous, most violent piece of real estate in the sport, the slot.
The slot is conceptually simple, but tactically complex. Geometrically, it is the rectangular area directly in front of the net, situated between the two large face-off circles.
It is the prime real estate.
It is. If you look at shot maps, the vast, overwhelming majority of goals in ice hockey are scored from the slot. But a beginner looks at the slot and just sees one big danger zone.
And an expert.
An expert, a coach, or a defenseman looks at the slot and sees three highly distinct, specialized layers, and each layer requires a completely different defensive philosophy.
Walk us through those three layers. Break down the biomechanics of what happens in each zone.
Let's start furthest from the net, the high slot. This is the area located between the two face-off dots, extending upward toward the top of the face-off circles.
What kind of plays happen there?
This is the shooting layer. It is a sniper's paradise. If an elite shooter finds a pocket of open space in the high slot, they have the physical time required to receive a pass, load their weight onto their stick, flex the carbon fiber shaft, and fire a high-velocity snapshot or one-timer.
They have the time to look at the goalie and pick a specific corner.
Exactly. So defending the high slot is about denying time and space. You can't let a shooter set their feet.
Got it. And the next layer down.
Now, as we move closer to the net, we enter the low slot. This area runs from the face-off dots down toward the edge of the goal crease. The hockey played in the low slot is entirely different. It is messy, violent, and chaotic.
You are not taking clean 90-mile-an-hour snapshots from the low slot.
No, because there's no room to wind up. The low slot is the domain of tips, deflections, and rebounds. It's where massive players establish physical positioning to screen the goaltender. The physics of scoring here change.
How so?
A forward isn't trying to overpower the goalie with velocity. They're trying to beat the goalie's reaction time by altering the vector of the puck. A shot comes from the blue line, and a forward in the low slot just taps it with the blade of their stick, changing its trajectory by 5 degrees.
And that's enough.
The goalie's brain has already calculated the initial trajectory, and they physically cannot reset their body fast enough to stop the deflection.
And then there's the final layer, right on the precipice of the blue paint.
The goal mouth. This is the immediate perimeter of the crease. There are no shots here. There are only tap-ins, jam plays, and desperation sweeps at loose pucks.
So, if I'm a listener trying to build my mental model, why does slicing the slot into these three micro-regions matter? Why can't I just tell my defenseman, hey, protect the front of the net?
Because treating the slot as one big zone is the number one cause of blown defensive assignments in amateur hockey.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Defending a sniper in the high slot requires a completely different assignment than defending a player looking for a tap-in at the goal mouth. In a standard zone defense, your weak side defenseman, the one furthest from the puck, is strictly responsible for locking down the goal mouth. That is their only job. They cannot leave.
Let me guess. The puck gets passed to the high slot, that defenseman panics, and they abandon the goal mouth to go chase the puck.
That happens 100 times a night in recreational leagues.
I can picture it perfectly.
The defenseman steps up into the high slot to pressure the shooter. The shooter immediately recognizes the blown assignment, slides a pass down to the goal mouth, and an attacker is standing completely alone for an empty net tap-in.
Brutal.
The defenseman has to trust their center to handle the high slot while they maintain their structural discipline at the goal mouth.
That discipline relies on understanding the geometry. And speaking of geometry, modern spatial analytics has given us a new defining shape to memorize. We've moved beyond just talking about the slot. We now talk about a specific polygon called home plate.
Also referred to by coaches as the house. I love this visualization because it translates complex analytics into a shape everyone recognizes. It looks exactly like a five-sided baseball home plate, just scaled up.
Draw the lines for us. How do I map home plate on the ice?
Imagine a straight horizontal line running across the ice, connecting the tops of the two face-off circles.
Okay, got it.
From the ends of that line, draw two straight vertical lines down to the two face-off dots. From the dots, angle the lines inward so they converge perfectly at the two goalposts. That five-sided polygon is home plate.
And why do modern data analysts care so obsessively about this specific shape?
Because home plate is the mathematical definition of a high-danger scoring chance. Analytics dictate that shots originating from inside home plate have an exponentially higher expected goal value than shots taken from outside it.
Why is it so much more dangerous?
It comes down to angles. If you shoot from outside home plate, the goaltender can push out of their crease, cut down the angle, and geometrically eliminate almost 100% of the visible net. The puck simply has nowhere to go.
But inside?
Inside home plate, the angles open up, and the shooter has the mathematical advantage.
So the entire sport, fundamentally, is a war over this five-sided shape. The offensive philosophy is entirely built around manipulating the defense to get the puck inside home plate.
Right.
And the defensive philosophy is entirely built around barricading the perimeter to keep the puck outside of it.
Exactly. Which brings us to the real estate outside of home plate, the perimeter.
This is where the puck spends most of its time during an offensive possession.
It does. And there are two specific locations on the perimeter that beginners constantly confuse, and mixing them up creates structural disasters. I'm talking about the half wall and the point.
Let's define them distinctly. What's the half wall?
The half wall is the area along the sideboards that is roughly level with the face-off dot. It is the command center for the offense. Think of a basketball point guard running an offense from the top of the key.
So they are setting up the play.
In hockey, the winger standing on the half wall is the point guard. They have the puck on their stick, their head is up, and they have passing lanes radiating out in every direction. They can pass down low to the corner, pass into the slot for a shot, or pass backward to the point.
And the point is where the defensemen live.
Yes,
Huh.
the point is the area situated just inside the blue line near the boards. It is the highest piece of real estate in the offensive zone.
So here's a scenario that tests our listeners' spatial awareness. Let's say I'm playing defense. I'm stationed at the point, just inside the blue line. The puck gets chipped down the boards, and my winger loses a battle for it.
Okay, I see where this is going.
So I decide to slide down the wall, leaving the blue line, to go fight for the puck at the half wall. I win the puck. Have I made a good play?
You might have won the puck, but you have committed a massive structural error.
Why is that an error?
The point and the half wall are not interchangeable locations. If a defenseman drifts all the way down to the face-off dot, they are essentially playing the winger position. By abandoning the point, they have left the blue line completely unguarded.
And if the opposing team steals that puck on the half wall,
There is nobody home. The
you don't.
opposing winger just chips the puck past you, and it's an immediate uncontested odd man rush or a breakaway going the other direction.
So you have to stay disciplined.
The structural integrity of the entire offensive zone system relies on the defenseman holding the point and barricading the blue line.
It's all connected. The blue line, the zones, the scoring areas. We have spent the last half hour mapping out the nouns of the ice. We have the rink boundaries, the physical lines, the 3D goalie crease, the slot, home plate, the half wall, and the point.
We have the map.
We have the map. Now we need the language to actually navigate it. This brings us to relational vocabulary. We need the adjectives and verbs. We need the directional language that dictates the flow of play.
Right, because a coach doesn't say skate to the north end of the rink. They use a highly specific, totally fluid coordinate system.
And remember the foundational rule we established in the intro, these terms are entirely relative. They change based on momentum and possession. Let's start with the most basic axis, high versus low.
High means moving toward the blue line that you are currently facing. Low means moving toward the goal line you are currently attacking or defending.
I can see a listener immediately identifying the trap here. This sounds like an Abbott and Costello routine.
It really can be.
If my team is in the offensive zone and we are cycling the puck, high means moving back toward the blue line, away from the net. But the second we turn the puck over and the other team starts skating toward our zone,
The axis instantly
it
flips.
flips.
The instant possession changes, and you turn around to skate back on defense. The blue line you are now facing is your own defensive blue line. So now high means something completely different.
It's all relative to where you're going.
You always measure high and low relative to the net that is tactically relevant in that exact fraction of a second.
Okay, that handles the vertical axis. What about the horizontal axis? The terms strong side versus weak side.
This is dictated purely by the location of the puck. If you draw an imaginary line right down the center of the rink, splitting it lengthwise into two halves,
Okay, give it the line.
the strong side is simply whichever half of the ice currently contains the puck. The weak side, or back side, is the half of the ice that does not have the puck.
And this flips constantly. Every time there's a cross-ice pass, the strong and weak sides invert.
Multiple times per shift. It requires an immense amount of cognitive load for defensemen because they are constantly working as a tethered pair.
How do they manage that?
One defenseman is always aggressively attacking the puck carrier on the strong side, closing the gap and forcing a play. The other defenseman must immediately recognize that they are on the weak side, retreat to the slot, and guard the goal mouth.
Because the weak side is actually where the most lethal threats emerge. Specifically, a term I hear all the time, the back door.
The back door is the weak side net front area. It is deadly because of human physiology.
Physiology, how so?
When the puck is on the strong side half wall, the goaltender must be physically squared up to the shooter, staring at the puck. That means the entire weak side of the ice is literally outside the goalie's peripheral vision.
Oh, wow.
If an attacking player sneaks down into the weak side goal mouth, the backdoor ridge up, they are invisible to the goalie. A pass across the ice to the back door results in an almost guaranteed goal, because the goalie is looking the wrong way.
Which perfectly sets up the next set of terms, inside versus outside. You mentioned earlier that defensive hockey can basically be reduced to a single mantra.
Yes. Be inside, force them outside.
Let's break down the mechanics of that.
Inside means the middle of the ice. It is the real estate that contains home plate and the slot. Outside means the perimeter, the space along the boards.
So what's the defensive goal?
Defensively, your absolute primary objective is to keep your physical body positioned between the attacker and the middle of the ice. You want to deny them access to the inside.
You are angling them toward the boards.
Yes. You use your stick and your body position to steer them to the outside.
And why is that so effective?
Because of the geometry we talked about earlier. If you force a player to shoot from the outside boards, the angle to the net is so narrow that a professional goaltender will save that shot 99 times out of 100. It is a harmless, low-percentage play. The defense wins.
The final relational concept on the vertical axis is above the puck versus below the puck.
This is fundamentally about risk management. It is how coaches calculate danger.
Explain above the puck.
Being above the puck means you are physically positioned between the puck and the net your team is currently defending. You are the safety valve. If the puck turns over, you are already in a position to defend against the counterattack.
And being below the puck?
That means you are closer to the offensive net than the puck is. If your team turns the puck over, you are tracked behind the play. You are completely useless defensively.
So what's the rule of thumb?
The ultimate unbreakable coaching rule of thumb is someone must always stay above the puck. If all five skaters get below the puck in the offensive zone trying to score a goal and the puck pops loose,
you give up a breakaway.
It's a catastrophic failure of structure.
Now, I want to tie all of this directional language into one massive unifying analytical concept. We talk about north-south hockey and east-west hockey.
Right.
North-south means playing direct, pushing the puck straight up and down the ice. It is fast, it is territorially aggressive, and it is safe.
That's right.
East-west hockey means passing the puck laterally, sideways across the width of the ice. It is slower, and it is highly dangerous because a lateral pass is easily intercepted.
So true.
So I have to ask, if playing direct north-south hockey is so safe and effective for gaining territory, why do elite teams ever risk passing east-west in the offensive zone?
Because east-west movement is the only way to shatter modern defensive structure. Specifically, you must force the puck to cross the most important invisible line on the ice. The Royal Road.
The Royal Road. It sounds incredibly dramatic. What exactly is it?
The term was popularized by a former NHL goaltender turned analyst, Steve Ellicott. Imagine an invisible line running lengthwise right down the absolute center axis of the rink, splitting the ice into a left half and a right half.
Okay.
That line slices directly through the center of the slot and ends at the middle of the net. That is the Royal Road.
Yeah, I have the visual. Now explain the biomechanics of why passing across that specific line is so lethal.
It's about how a goaltender's body actually functions. When a shooter has the puck on the left side of the ice, the goalie's on their feet, squared up with their edges dug into the ice, tracking the puck.
They're ready.
If the shooter just fires a north-south shot, the goalie is already in perfect position to block it.
But if they pass?
If the shooter passes the puck laterally, completely across the Royal Road to a teammate on the right side of the ice, the goalie goes into crisis mode.
What do you mean, crisis mode?
The goalie cannot just stand up and shuffle. They have to release their skate edges from the ice, violently push off with their leg, slide laterally across the crease, and attempt to reestablish their edge control and square up to a completely new angle.
And that takes time.
It takes roughly 0.5 to 0.7 seconds for a human being to complete that lateral movement. A one-timer shot from an elite player takes about 0.1 seconds to release. The math overwhelmingly favors the shooter.
Wow.
While the goalie is sliding sideways, holes open up in their stance, specifically the five hole between their legs and the space under their arms. The Royal Road cross seam pass is mathematically the highest value, highest danger play in the sport of hockey.
It essentially doubles your expected chance of scoring compared to a shot from a straight on angle.
It does.
So the grand unified theory of offensive hockey is play north-south to safely transport the puck through the neutral zone. But the second you establish possession inside the offensive zone, you must pass east-west across the Royal Road to break the goalie's stance.
Exactly. You use the geometry against the goaltender's physiology.
That is an incredible insight. It completely changes how you watch a power play. You stop watching the puck and you start watching teams probe for passing lanes across that center axis.
Once you see it, you can't unsee it.
This brings us to the final piece of our puzzle, Section 6, roles versus positions. We understand the physical architecture of the rink. We understand the relative directional language. Now, we finally need to populate the ice with players and understand how they navigate this shifting geometry.
Let's put the pieces on the board.
I want to talk about F1, F2, and F3.
When a casual fan looks at a roster, they see positions: center, left wing, right wing. And they assume those titles lock players into specific lanes on the ice.
Like a foosball table.
Right. But when a game is actually in motion at 20 miles an hour, coaches don't use those terms to dictate tactics. They use a system of chronological roles: F1, F2, and F3.
Chronological meaning it's based on time, not position on a depth chart.
Precisely. It is based entirely on the order of arrival to a specific situation on the ice. Think of it like a tactical breach team entering a room.
Let's follow that analogy. Walk me through a team dumping the puck into the corner and establishing a forecheck.
Okay, the puck is dumped into the corner.
Yeah.
F1 is simply the first forward to physically arrive at the puck. Their job is immediate aggressive pressure.
They are the first one through the door.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
They hit the opposing defenseman, separate them from the puck, and create chaos.
So F1's job is disruption. What about F2?
F2 is the second forward to arrive at the zone. Their job is support. They read where the puck is squirting loose after F1 makes contact, and they swoop in to retrieve it.
Or they seal off the boards.
Right, they seal off the most obvious passing lane along the boards. They are sweeping the room.
And F3.
F3 is the third forward to arrive. Their job is structural security. They do not dive into the corner. They stay high in the zone, usually around the face-off dot or the blue line, acting as the safety valve.
They're making sure nobody escapes out the back door.
They stay above the puck, as we learned earlier, to ensure that if F1 and F2 lose the battle, the other team doesn't get a breakaway.
I can clearly see how a novice team would completely butcher this, because they are locked into thinking about their roster positions, not their chronological roles.
It is the most common structural failure in beginner hockey. A player thinks, "I'm the center, so F1 is my job."
So they force it.
Right. The puck is dumped into the corner. The right winger is 5 feet away from it, but because they think, "I'm a winger, I don't go first," they stop skating and wait for the center, who is 30 feet away, to skate over and retrieve it.
By the time the center gets there, the defense is already broken out.
Exactly. Or even worse, the winger goes in as F1, but the center, insisting on playing their position, chases the winger directly into the same corner.
Now you have F1 and F2 stacked on top of each other.
Completely neutralizing their effectiveness and leaving nobody playing F3 high in the zone.
The structural integrity evaporates because they couldn't grasp the fluid rotation. The reality is, if you are the closest player to the puck, you are F1, period. It doesn't matter if you have a C next to your name on the lineup card.
Exactly. You are playing a role dictated by geography and timing, not a fixed position.
The last spatial variable we need to cover before we synthesize all of this is the actual physical anatomy of the player, specifically handedness, left shot versus right shot. How does the way a player holds their stick alter their spatial positioning on the ice? Let's start with defensemen.
For defensemen, handedness dictates almost everything. It is extremely rigid. Coaches strongly prefer to play a left shot defenseman on the left side of the ice and a right shot defenseman on the right side.
This is called playing on their natural side.
Yes.
Why is that structural alignment so critical? Why can't a right-handed guy just play the left side?
Because of where the blade of the stick ends up. If you are a left shot playing on the left side, the blade of your stick naturally points toward the middle or the inside of the rink.
And that's important for passing.
This alignment is crucial for breakouts. Picture a defenseman going backward into their own corner to retrieve a dumped-in puck. If they're on their natural side, they pick up the puck on their forehand.
Right.
They can keep their momentum moving forward, look up the ice, and immediately make a strong forehand pass to their winger on the half wall.
And if they are playing on their offside.
If a right shot defenseman is forced to play on the left side, they retrieve that same puck on their backhand. A backhand pass is weak and inaccurate. To make a strong pass, they have to physically pivot their entire body to get the puck onto their forehand.
That pivot takes a full second.
Right. In the NHL, a forechecker skating at 20 miles an hour covers 15 feet of ice in 1 second.
Oh.
That pivot will literally get you crushed against the glass and cause a turnover. Furthermore, passing across the ice to your defensive partner, a D-to-D pass, is incredibly dangerous if your stick blade is pointing toward the outside boards. The puck has to travel across your body, increasing the risk of an interception.
So for defensemen, handedness is about structural safety, puck protection, and breakout efficiency. But for forwards, the philosophy seems to flip. Wingers actually seem to prefer playing on their off wing, a left shot playing on the right side.
Yes, especially elite offensive goal scorers.
Yeah.
While playing the off wing makes receiving passes on the boards harder during a breakout, it dramatically increases your lethality in the offensive zone.
How so?
When you play your off wing, your stick is positioned closer to the middle of the ice.
Which means it's closer to the Royal Road and closer to home plate.
Exactly. It completely opens up your shooting angle toward the net. If a right shot winger is skating down the left side, the puck is protected on the inside of their body, and they have the entire net visible to them.
And for one-timers?
It positions them perfectly to receive a cross-ice pass and instantly fire a one-timer, because they don't have to reach across their body to catch the puck. The stick is already loaded and pointing at the net.
So defensemen prioritize safety and angles on the perimeter, while wingers sacrifice perimeter safety for lethal angles in the middle.
You got it.
This brings us to the culmination of our deep dive. We have built the map. We have learned the language. Now we need to synthesize all of this into a coherent mental framework. Our goal was to help our listener view the ice not as a novice, but as an expert.
And the true mark of an expert is seeing the interconnectedness of all these rules and geometries.
Right.
An expert does not look at the ice as a static painting of lines and circles. They see a breathing, pulsating grid. They know the grid stretches or shrinks, depending on whether they're standing in an NHL arena, a European Olympic stadium, or a compressed local rink in the UK.
It's all relative.
They know the labels of the zones swap every 20 minutes, and they know that terms like high, low, inside, and outside flip instantly based on who controls the puck.
When a coach is standing on the bench trying to process the absolute chaos of 10 skaters flying around at 20 miles an hour, bouncing a rubber disc off composite walls, they aren't tracking 10 individual players.
No, the cognitive load is too high. Coaches chunk the ice into these relative concepts. They evaluate structural integrity.
What are they asking themselves?
They ask themselves, do we have an F3 staying above the puck? Are our defensemen keeping their bodies inside and forcing the attackers outside? Are we successfully barricading home plate?
And on offense.
Offensively, are we manipulating the puck across the Royal Road to shatter the goalie's lateral edge control?
Let's distill this entire masterclass into the most vital takeaways. If a listener is going to retain the core architecture of hockey long term, what are the pillars of that mental model?
First and foremost, zones belong to the team, not the paint on the ice. Eliminate offensive zone and defensive zone from your vocabulary. Train your brain to say our end and their end.
It immediately clarifies your spatial orientation regardless of the period. The relative map, okay, what about the lines?
Respect the physical volume of the lines. The blue line is a 12-inch buffer zone designed for toe drag entries. The center red line requires geometric precision. The puck must be physically on the stick blade when it touches the paint to nullify icing.
And the goalie's territory?
The goalie's domain is absolute, but invisible. The crease is a three-dimensional block of protected airspace. Stay completely off the red boundary line to avoid interference.
And the trapezoid.
And understand the history of the trapezoid. Know whether your specific league legally permits your goalie to act as a third defenseman in the corners, because it dictates how your entire team breaks out of the zone.
What about player movement?
Understand chronological roles over static positions. F1, F2, and F3 are a tactical rotation based entirely on who arrives at the puck first, second, and third. If you are closest, it is your job.
And finally, the golden rule of defense, combining geometry and strategy.
Be inside, force them outside, barricade home plate, protect the Royal Road, and force the opponent to take low percentage shots from the perimeter where the goaltender has the mathematical advantage.
This has been an absolutely incredible breakdown. Thank you for walking us through this. We have peeled back the layers of the rule books, the rink dimensions, and the spatial analytics.
It was a pleasure.
You, the listener, are now equipped with the coach's secret language. You have the mental map to truly read the architectural flow of the game. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought.
Let's hear it.
Building on everything we discussed today about the geometry of the rink, the physics of goaltending, and the power of the Royal Road, we know that modern analytics prove that a cross-seam pass over the Royal Road is the deadliest weapon in the sport.
Undeniably.
And we know that modern defensive systems are entirely architected to protect the geometric shape of home plate in the center of the ice. So, consider the future of the sport as it continues to expand globally into non-standard infrastructure.
Think about those community rinks.
Right. Think about those community rinks in the UK or older barns across Europe, which are actively authorized to be significantly shorter and narrower than international minimums. If the physical length of the rink shrinks, the end zones shrink.
Exactly.
If the end zones shrink, home plate takes up a massively disproportionate amount of the available space. Does that hyper-compressed geometry actually make defending the Royal Road easier because there is literally less square footage for the defensemen to patrol?
That's a good question.
Or does shrinking the ice force an entirely new hyper-aggressive, chaotic style of offensive hockey? A style where home plate is under constant violent siege from every possible angle because the safe perimeter, the half wall, and the point simply doesn't exist anymore.
It changes everything.
Think about how the physical shape of the ice doesn't just dictate the rules. It shapes the biomechanics, the strategy, and the entire evolutionary future of the sport. Until next time.